Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Welcome back, and it is now or never. You know, I don't want to do too many go-backs regarding yesterday's show, but I'd already received some feedback that, you know, I left out chemtrails. And so if you want to look at, you know, the broad scope of warfare and attacks, go read my constitutional minutes, the very first one for 2023. It's on the constitutional articles page, and you can see more of a comprehensive list. But bottom line, if one was looking at what is America's strategy for its future, it is to destroy its constitution and take the liberty away from its people. All the while, the people are being bathed and immersed in debauchery and immorality and addictive behavior, drugs, and so forth. And, oh boy, you know, do we have it going on here? Anywho. We are in the midst of the Pennsylvania debates, and I'm going to pick up where Paul and I left off last Thursday. Now, one of the things, and I hope I to remember when we talk with Paul tomorrow, but one of the things that I am trying to do, because I've noticed it's hard, if you're reading along with us, then when we go into editorializing, it's kind of hard. So what I, and before when I did this all by myself, I, you know, was a little more disciplined. I tried not to editorialize. Sometimes I'd lose control. You know, that tongue just runs away with me. But anyway, I, for your benefit and for everybody's benefit, I really want to try to not interrupt. And if I do, it's only to point something out without getting into detail. And then once I'm done with the portion of the ratification debates, because what I want to read is, because those of you who are driving, those of you who are doing something, you know, it's nice to hear the words succinctly, and, you know, and so you actually can hear them all together. If I start editorializing, and I've realized I've kind of done this, and I've gotten back into reading, you don't know what was editorialized and what was reading. And so I need to do really better with, you know, breaking away and saying, hold on, let me break away and let me get back to, okay. So I need to do those types of things to help you, because I don't want you to think I'm actually trying to put words in their mouth. And as a matter of fact, if anything, my intent in doing this is I'm reading this for many of you who don't have the time to actually read. And so it's that important. I believe that this is the best service I can do for the nation. And you know what's in it for me? I get smarter and smarter on the ratification debates. And as I do, I become far more of a formidable enemy for all of these people who think they understand the Constitution, who are, you know, playing manipulative games and all sorts of, you know, nefarious deeds, you know, with our government and with our society and so forth. And it's all unconstitutional. And I know it is, and I can prove it is. And this is why, you know, my petitions, when I write them, I actually try to include the ratification debates, because these are legal terms to the compact. These definitions that were provided, these are actually legal. The problem is that the states haven't adopted that yet. The states need to adopt that. This is as Madison basically stated, this is fundamental compact law and in the nature of contracts itself. So when we look at why we haven't gotten there, I mean, nobody can argue that I'm wrong. The problem is that nobody wants to apply these definitions, and they'd rather wander around in the mysterious, ambiguous fog so that they can go the direction towards the siren song. And you know what danger that leads. This is why we need to clear the fog. We need to actually understand how the Constitution was defined. And the ratification debates are the only ways to do this. So, and I appreciate the feedback. Please get that petition out, get it signed, get other people to read it on the digital currency, and we'll talk about more of this stuff on Feedback Friday. With that, please subscribe to the Reclaiming the Republic YouTube channel. And when we do the obligatories and everything else, you always want to include, the show is also sponsored by republicreview.org. And this is the only show that gives you the academic evidence and academic evidence-based solutions. And this is the, I'll call it the golden egg here. Going through the ratification debates, this is the creme de la creme. I mean, this is, you know, the best content that I can give you. And it's actually, I'm only the medium. I'm only the deliverer, right? I'm just the paper boy throwing the newspaper on your doorstep. I mean, you have to actually take the focus and listen to what these guys are saying so that you can understand. And so anyway, let me stop self-effacing and let me just get into the first topic. And so where we left off, it was Tuesday, December 4th, and we were just about ready to end the day where they were going to take a break and then come back at the end of the day, or what they call EODEM die PM. In other words, same day evening. So anyway, the Commerce is this little blurb. The letter, this is Wilson. The letter which accompanies this Constitution must strike every person with the utmost force. Quote, "The friends of our country have long seen and desired that the power of war, peace, and treaties, that of levying money and regulating commerce, and the corresponding executive and judicial authority should be fully and effectually vested in the general government of the Union. But the impropriety of delegating such extensive trust to one body of men is evident. Hence results the necessity of a different organization," which required a different constitution. And close quote. I mean, it ended with, "Hence results the necessity of a different organization," close quote. And so that's when I started editorializing. And bottom line, it required a different constitution, and the constitution had to identify to the detail what powers, roles, responsibilities, and property that this government had sovereignty over, had the ultimate say over. And I'm telling you, folks, it's very, very limited. Most people think, oh, it's terrible, they got all these controls, when really they don't have. Now, this next one's kind of long. And actually, so one of the things that you may have noticed, because I talked about this during the administrative part of the convention, that they weren't to call out anybody's names during the debates. You'll notice that in this, it actually has names, because we say Mr. Findley, Mr. Whitehill, what have you. And that's all in parentheses. And the only reason that they inserted this was an after the fact, so that, you know, even though they didn't actually say this, they took notes so that everybody understood reading this who said that. And I find it interesting that it was okay to put in the document, but they didn't want it to be said in the open public. You know what I mean? Is that a contradiction? Was the rule a contradiction? I don't know. Maybe what they did was they created the rule that you couldn't do that, but didn't mean that they couldn't document it. Anyway, maybe they just didn't realize that they weren't covering all their bases. Regardless, this part of the Pennsylvania debate we're going to talk about or go through, and it's kind of extensive, is about slavery. And so this is what it says. I recollect on a former day, and again, this is Mr. Wilson, "I recollect on a former day the honorable gentleman from Westmoreland and the Honorable Gentleman from Cumberland took exceptions against the first clause of the ninth section, Article 1, arguing very unfairly that because Congress might impose a tax or duty of $10 on the importation of slaves within the United States, Congress might therefore permit slaves to be imported within this state, contrary to its laws. I confess I little thought that this part of the system could be expected to. I am sorry that it could be extended no further, but so far as it operates, it presents us with a pleasing prospect of the rights of mankind will be acknowledged and established throughout the Union. If there was no other lovely feature in the Constitution but this one, it would diffuse a beauty over its whole continents. Yet the lapse of a few years and Congress will have a power to exterminate slavery from within our borders. How would such a delightful prospect expand the breast of a benevolent and philanthropic European? Would he cavil, and so cavil basically quibble or complain, at an expression? Catch at a phrase? No, sir. That is only reserved for the gentleman on the other side of your chair to do. What would be the exultation of that great man, whose name I have just now mentioned, we may learn from the following sentiments on this subject. They cannot be expressed so well as in his own words, Volume 1, page 329, and now he actually quotes and he's from what he's reading. The colonies of France contain, as we have seen, near 500,000 slaves, and it is from the number of these wretches and inhabitants set a value on their plantations. What a fatal prospect, and how profound a subject for reflection. Alas, how inconsequent we are, both in our morality and our principles. We preach up humanity and yet go every year to bind in chains thousands of natives of Africa. We call the Moors barbarians and ruffians because they attack the liberty of Europeans at the risk of their own. Yet these Europeans go without danger and as mere spectators to purchase slaves by gratifying the cupidity of their masters and excite all those bloody scenes which are the usual preliminaries of this traffic. In short, we pride ourselves on the superiority of man, and it is with reason that we discover the superiority in the wonderful, mysterious unfolding of the intellectual faculties. And yet the trifling difference in the hair of the head or in the color of the epidermis is sufficient to change our respect into contempt and to engage us to place beings like ourselves in the rank of those animals devoid of reason, whom we subject to the yoke that we may make use of their strength and their instinct at command. Quote, and he's still reading. I am sensible and I grieve at it that these reflections, which others have much made, or made much better than I, are unfortunately of very little use. The necessity of supporting sovereign power has its peculiar laws, and the wealth of nations is one of the foundations of this power. Thus, the sovereign should be the most thoroughly convinced of what is due to humanity, would not singly renounce the service of slaves in his colonies. Time alone could furnish a population of free people to replace them, and the great difference that would exist in the price of labor would give so great an advantage to the nation that would adhere to the old custom that others would soon be discouraged in wishing to be more virtuous. And yet, would it be a commercial project to propose a general compact by which all the European nations could unanimously agree to abandon the traffic of African slaves. They would, in that case, find themselves exactly in the same proportion relative to each other as at present, for it is only on comparative riches may the calculations of the power be founded. Now, he goes on and continues to read. There's a couple more, you know, short paragraphs here that I'm going to go ahead and just not cover, but he's really painting the picture that, you know, America and its slaves and the fact that the shift to African slaves became the, I'll just say, the labor force du jour for Western society in the late 1600s, the 17th century. And the fact is that as one looks at the European nations, they had already populated themselves with slaves of different cultures, you know, from India and from all over the world. In other words, it was an equal opportunity enslavement that most Western society was using. And now when they discovered this new beckoning slave trade coming out of Africa, where, you know, they were, and this is why the King of England basically made it law that only African slaves would be slaves in the American colonies. And but it wasn't just the English monarch that did that. More and more nations started, you know, exploiting the African tradesmen who were selling their enemies, you know, on the, you know, on the slave stands or whatever you want to call it, you know. And I'm just going, wow. I mean, when you hear the American education system and when you hear what's being preached today, one would think that America invented slavery. But to actually be that myopic, to be that, what's the better word for it? To be that blinded in trust of who is telling you, if one doesn't do the due diligence when looking into the history of slavery, then one is doing themselves a huge disservice. Because if we look at, you know, the periods of slavery, the greatest period of slavery by any government bar none was Egypt, because it was the longest running empire on the face of the earth. And they had slaves for centuries, 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 up until the very end, where their last few slaves were Israel. Interesting. And that those slaves were emancipated, not by the Pharaoh's hand, but really by God's hand. God forced the Pharaoh into finally freeing them. And this is one of the reasons why you will never be taught this in school. This will not be an American education, because it actually validates the fact that there is a God, that God has played in the affairs of man throughout the annals of mankind's history. And so I'm here to tell you folks that, you know, when we read these things and you look and you go, wow, I mean, Europe was truly benefiting, where they were talking about, you know, France having all of these African slaves and how they were all going to Africa, this slave trade. See, what was happening was Portugal and Spain was the first nations to actually start exporting those slaves over to the colonies. Then when other nations said, hey, you know what, look at what they're doing. You know, they're using these, it's not like we're using our own countrymen, and it's not like, you know, we're going to great expense. You know, here's a market that's wide open and just easy to, you know, exploit. Let's go do that. And that's what all of Europe was doing. And you got to remember that there wasn't a European nation that was in Africa enslaving these people. It was the African people that was doing it to their enemies and getting rid of their enemies. And instead of killing them all off, they just made money off of it. And they became rich nations on selling labor. And it's kind of like oil. The problem is that Africa didn't ever, you know, realize the gem, or, you know, look at how much Saudi Arabia became so opulent from selling oil. Well, how long was Africa selling slaves? A few hundred years. Well, how long has Saudi Arabia been selling oil? And look at how opulent they are. Now, maybe there was this ease of selling, but I would have thunk, you know, and anybody should have thunk that, you know, for selling slaves from the late 1500s into the 1800s, you would think that there would be some real riches that would have been, you know, identifiable in Africa. And there may be. I'm just completely ignorant to it, because it doesn't seem like, it's almost like, look at Spain and Portugal today, because they stole all of the gold from America, and they're one of the poorest nations. I mean, their economy is just in turmoil. They're broke. What happened to all that gold? What happened to all those coins and that money? What happened, folks? This is where you actually see, you know, this spendthriftness. You actually see when people, you know, they don't think about building their, you know, I'll just say an enterprise. They just start spending the money and wasting it. A good friend of mine told me he learned a really good lesson, you know, about thieving, because he became a thief when he was a young man, before he got into the Marine Corps. And he basically went down this path of stealing, and it took him a little while to realize that everything he stole just slipped through his hands. And he said it wasn't until he actually started earning and purchasing that he took care of everything and he safeguarded everything. But when you're stealing it from others, you have no care. I mean, if that one goes away, you'll steal another one. And so the paradigm is that you appreciate things more when you work for them. And slavery and the slave market is it's the ultimate of corruption, just due to the fact that you're stealing the liberty and life of others. And you would think that the outcome, you know, the economic outcome, like oil, look at the difference in Saudi Arabia and or some of these Arab nations like Dubai. You know how rich they are and what they've done with all of that money. How come Africa didn't do that? And when you really think about the immorality of what they were doing, it kept them from ever building an empire. And it was, in all honesty, it is a scar that mars Africa to this day. Regardless of what, you know, the finger pointers at America and the Western society, the deepest scar has to be pointed at Africa and those people who actually created the market for slaves to go throughout the world. And anybody that gets involved in those types of things, it is a scourge on society. Anyway, let me get back into this. We've got, less than a minute, actually less than 20 seconds left. So the next part we're going to talk about are state constraints. And so this is the last comment on the evening, Tuesday evening, December 4th, made by Mr. Wilson before they take a break and adjourn to come back the next day. So after this break, and if you notice, we're covering a lot more content now because I've gotten rid of two promos. So it's literally just the one promo and then the promo at the very end. So with that, we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. Okay, so now we have a long segment. And so this is on state constraints, as I was just telling you. This is Mr. Wilson again, stating, permit me to make a single observation. In this place, on the restraints placed on the state governments, if only the following lines were inserted in this Constitution, I think it would be worth our adoption. No state shall hereafter emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in the payments of debts, pass any bills of attainder, ex post facto law, or law impairing the obligation of contracts. Fatal experience has taught us, dearly taught us, the value of these restraints. What is the consequence at this moment? It is true, we have no tender law in Pennsylvania, but the moment you are conveyed across Delaware, you find it haunt your journey and follow close upon your heels. The paper passes commonly at 25 or 30% discount. How insecure is property? So in other words, the money that they would take out of Pennsylvania, their script that they created, when you go over across the Delaware to a different state, it instantly loses, what do they say, 25 to 30% of its value. Folks, that is the problem. Here is Wilson pointing out the problem with paper money and why the Constitution got rid of it altogether. The key thing he pointed out was the adoption of the currency going to metal. Because a silver dollar, 1 ounce of silver, the value of it is the same in each of the states. It is a consistent currency and backed by itself. It is not backed by the United States government. It is minted for the people and for the states by the government, but it is not the property of the government. It is a supply that they create, and they create it based on necessity of, you know, their revenues and their procurements. So in other words, you know, they can't spend money that they don't have. So they either have to tax it or they have to coin it and then use that to actually pay, and they actually provide wealth to the states when they do that. When they create a dollar today on a piece of paper, it creates no wealth, no real tangible wealth to the state, the person, etc. So, moving on, the next day the first topic we're going to cover, and we're only cherry picking, right? But we've got a lot to cover, and you'll see how much we actually have in Pennsylvania. This is, again, Mr. Wilson. It's December 7th. It's Friday. And this happens to be, because interestingly enough, they went Tuesday, and then they had a break from Wednesday and Thursday, so there was 2 days that they don't account for. Now, this may be when the anti-federalists basically got up and made their arguments, and so, you know, then on Friday, it starts off with Mr. Wilson. Mr. Wilson starts talking about treaties, and he says this, "The judicial power extends to all cases arising under treaties made or which shall be made by the United States. I shall not repeat at this time what has been said with regard to the power of the states to make treaties. It cannot be controverted that when made, they ought to be observed. But it is highly proper that this regulation should be made, for the truth is, and I am sorry to say it, that in order to prevent the payment of British debts and other causes, our treaties have been violated, and violated too by the expensive laws of several states in the Union. Pennsylvania, to her honor be it spoken, has hitherto done no act of this kind, but it is acknowledged on all sides that many states in the Union have infringed the treaty, and it is well known when the Minister of the United States made a demand of Lord Carmarthen of a surrender of the Western Post, he told the minister with truth and justice, quote, the treaty under which you claim those possessions has not been performed on your part until it is done. Those possessions will not be delivered up. This clause, sir, will show that the world that we make faith of treaties a constitutional part of the character of the United States, that we secure it performance no longer nominal, for the judges of the United States will be enabled to carry it into effect, let the legislatures of the different states do what they may. And then the next step is he starts talking about jurisdiction. And so he kind of, the segue is this, that the power of judges extends to all cases affecting ambassadors and other public ministers and consuls. I presume very little objection will be offered to this clause. On the contrary, it will be allowed proper and unexceptionable. Then he gets into jurisdiction. This will also be allowed with regard to the following clause, quote, all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction. The next is, quote, to controversies to which the United States shall be a party, close quote. Now, I apprehend it is something very incongruous that because the United States are a party, it should be urged as an objection that their judges ought not to decide when the universal practice of all nations has and unavoidably must have admitted of this power. But say the gentleman, the sovereignty of the states is destroyed if they should be engaged in controversy with the United States, because a suitor in a court must acknowledge the jurisdiction of that court, and it is not a custom of sovereigns to suffer their names to be made use of in this manner. The answer is plain and easy. The government of each state ought to be subordinate to the government of the United States. Now, he's speaking really in general terms of the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court over all cases where the United States and a state is a party to it with foreign nations. In other words, no state can go into court and represent themselves in a foreign court. It has to be the federal government and or the Supreme Court to actually have the case argued in America, not in an international court. We're not to recognize international courts. So bottom line, when it comes down to negotiating, you know, quabbles and problems and so forth, if it comes down to a court settlement, it would be the United States, and it really comes down to ambassadors and chancellors and so forth, to actually work out the deals, because nobody in France would go and recognize and be submitted to another court. But when France, and I should say Europe, started creating international courts, when they started creating the European Union, this was the beginning. It was post-World War II. Actually, it was post-World War I when they started working in the League of Nations, and the American president, Woodrow Wilson, was the champion for bringing all these European nations together under a single government. And in so doing, they basically stripped them of their sovereignty. The United States actually does not recognize any other court. We're not to recognize, constitutionally, we're not to recognize any international court. It is one thing to deal internationally with a nation via ambassadors and so forth, but to be submitted to their laws and to be dictated, you know, it took a while for America to build this clout. But any person, any American that is imprisoned by a foreign court, you know, creates a huge issue with the United States. But today, because we're under this full frontal assault by our own politicians and our own government, it means nothing. So what we did in building that clout to where nobody would think about imprisoning American, I mean, this person had to be really guilty, because the American government could easily just say, we want that person back, because we had that kind of clout. Not anymore. Not anymore. And that's why you see that everything has gone back to, like, with Russia and, it, you know, exchanging and so forth, where, you know, we're not dictating anymore. And this is all because of the strategy of our politicians and the strategists who have been maintaining the direction of this country for over the past century. It is all the globalists who have been doing this. Anyway, so the next one is also about jurisdiction. And this is, quote, this is Wilson, and again, quote, between citizens of different states and between a state or the citizens thereof and foreign states, citizens or subjects, this part of the jurisdiction, I presume, will occasion more doubt than any other part. And at first view, it may seem exposed to objection well-founded and of great weight, but I apprehend that this can be the case only at first view. Permit me to observe here, with regard to this power or any other of the foregoing powers given to the federal court, that there is not exclusively given. In all instances, the parties may commence suits in the courts of the several states. Even the United States may submit to such decision if they think proper. Though the citizens of a state and the citizens or subjects of foreign states may sue in the federal court, it does not follow that they must sue. These are the instances in which the jurisdiction of the United States may be exercised, and we have all the reason in the world to believe that it will be exercised impartially, for it would be improper to infer that the judges would abandon their duty and rather for being independent. Such a sentiment is contrary to experience and ought not to be hazarded. If the people of the United States are fairly represented and the President and Senate are wise enough to choose men of abilities and integrity for judges, there can be no apprehension because, as I mentioned before, the government can have no interest on injuring the citizens. Now, we all know that this part of the Constitution, well, I think we all know that this part of the Constitution was actually amended to where the states actually pulled back their sovereignty and said, you will not have sovereignty, or you will not have the lead jurisdiction on cases between, you know, citizens of another state and or foreigners or what have you. And so, The states actually stepped in shortly after the Constitution had been, the ink had dried, and after the federal courts had proven that they were going to start pulling in jurisdiction when it should have been at the states, or at least the states felt that they needed to keep it, and they amended the Constitution to do so. And there you go, folks. The 11th Amendment was born. Now, the 11th Amendment has been ignored because the federal courts and everybody in the world goes to the federal courts first. I mean, when it comes to things that are supposed to be settled at the state level, you know, like look at the elections. Look at with the 2020 election, how many times did people go straight into the state court over something, or into the federal court over, you know, some improprieties of the state, you know, all these different state lawsuits that were jumping into the federal court system before they even had their day of justice in the state court. They completely bypassed the state courts. And that's why the Supreme Court was basically saying, you have no standing. You know, we don't have jurisdiction. This needs to go through the state court first. The only one that I'm aware of, the only one, because even the Brunson case didn't have this, the only one that actually pointed specifically to an argument, because clearly the Supreme Court and the Constitution has not delegated to the federal government these laws of corruptions or what have you, you know, or of collusion and whatever the Brunson case was. The only jurisdiction the federal government has over crimes committed is treason. So, I mean, if the lawsuit was a treasonous lawsuit, then yeah, the federal court would actually have jurisdiction. You know, I told Bob he needed to include the charge of treason in his. The Congress committed treason. They committed an insurrection. The language needed to be of such to prove that this had to go through the jurisdiction of the federal court. The Electoral College and everything that Bob's case was all about the Constitution and federal jurisdiction, federal roles, responsibilities, delegated. This had nothing to do with state court, state issues. So anyway, the next part of the jurisdiction then goes a little bit further. And he says, I will mention further. This again is Mr. Wilson. I will mention further on an object that I take to be particular magnitude, and I conceive these regulations will produce its accomplishment. The object, Mr. President, that I allude to is the improvement of our domestic navigation, the instrument of trade between the several states. Between the several states, provide credit which fell to decay from the destruction of our public credit by a too inefficient general government, will be restored, and this value intercourse among ourselves must give an increase to those useful improvements that will astonish the world. At present, how are we circumstanced? Merchants of eminence will tell you that they cannot trust their property to the laws of the state in which their correspondents live. Their friend may die and may be succeeded by a representative of a very different character. If there is any particular object that did not occur to me on this part of the Constitution, gentlemen will mention it, and I hope when this article is examined, it will be found to contain nothing but what is proper to be annexed to the general government. The next clause, so far as it gives original jurisdiction in cases affecting ambassadors, I apprehend is perfectly unexceptionable. It was thought proper to give citizens of foreign states full opportunity of obtaining justice in the general courts, and this they have by its appellate jurisdiction. Therefore, in order to restore credit with those foreign states, that part of the article is necessary. I believe the alteration that will take place in their minds when they learn the operation of this clause will be a great and important advantage to our country, nor is it anything but justice they ought to have the same security against the state laws that may be made that the citizens have, because regulations ought to be equally just in one case as in the other. Further, it is necessary in order to preserve peace with foreign nations. Let us suppose the case that wicked law is made in some one of the states, enabling a debtor to pay his creditor with the fourth, fifth, or sixth part of the real value of the debt. And this creditor, a foreigner, complains to his prince or sovereign of the injustice that has been done him. What can the prince or sovereign do? Bound by an inclination as well as duty to redress the wrong, his subject sustains from the hand of perfidy. And so what does perfidy mean? Perfidy is treachery, disloyalty, deceit, duplicity, and so forth. For those of you who want to expand your vernacular. From the hand of perfidy, he cannot apply to the particular guilty state because he knows that by the Articles of Confederation, it is declared that no state shall enter into treaties. He must therefore apply to the United States. The United States must be accountable. Quote, my subject has received a flagrant injury. Do me justice or I will do justice myself. Close quote. If the United States are answerable for the injury, ought they not possess the means of compelling the faulty state to repair it? They ought, and this is what is done here. For now, if complaint is made in consequence of such injustice, Congress can answer, why did not your subject apply to the general court where the unequal and partial laws of a particular state would have no force? In two cases of the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction, that affecting ambassadors and when a state be a party. It is true to its appeal of jurisdiction and more, but it will have it under such restrictions as the Congress shall ordain. I believe that any gentleman possessed of experience or knowledge on this subject will agree that it was impossible to further that any safety or propriety, and that it was best left in the manner in which it now stands. In all the cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact. The jurisdiction as to fact may be thought improper, but those possessed of information on his head see that it is necessary. We find it essentially necessary from the ample experience we have had in the courts of admiralty with regard to captures. Those gentlemen who, during the late war, had their vessels retaken know well what a poor chance they would have when those vessels were taken in their states and tried by juries, and in what a situation they would have been if the court appeals had not been possessed of the authority to reconsider and set aside the verdicts of those juries. Attempts were made by some of the states to destroy this power, but it has been confirmed in every instance. There are other cases in which it will be necessary, and will not Congress better regulate them as they rise from time to time than could they have done by the convention? Because if the regulations shall be attended with inconvenience, the Congress can alter them as soon as discovered. But anything done in convention must remain unalterable, but by the power of the citizen of the United States at large. I think these reasons will show that the powers given to the Supreme Court are not only safe, but constitute a wise and valuable part of the system. Okay, so the next part that we're going to cover, and I don't know if this will be the last part, it's a couple of good paragraphs, but this is about slavery. And so they get back into that. Let me just editorialize real quick on that last part. Understanding that as the Constitution moved forward, how quickly the states pulled back jurisdiction over lawsuits. I want you to understand that had we not had the 11th Amendment, states would not be able to go after Google, go after Facebook, go after Twitter, and go after all of the big tech that are making money in their state and not paying. And so they could literally have these people extradited because they're operating businesses within their states without actually, you know, filing for tax purposes for their revenue and everything else when they're actually making money in those states. And so that is something that the federal government would not have jurisdiction over. These states have full say over, you know, a business operating in their state. It's the same thing with freedom of speech and those types of things. The state has the ability and the responsibility to actually go after Facebook or Twitter or any social media or any type of medium that suppresses a person's speech. There's, when we start looking at what the 11th Amendment did, the 11th Amendment actually did secure, I believe, you know, better freedoms and better sovereignty from the federal government being able to just co-opt everything and take control of it. And that would not necessarily bode well. But the fact is, the 11th Amendment is being ignored. Now, I have about 2.5 minutes, so let me get through this. So this, again, is Mr. Wilson. The honorable gentleman from Fayette the other evening claimed for the minority the merit of contending for the rights of mankind, and he told us that it had been the practice of all ages to treat such minorities with contempt. He further took the liberty of observing that if the minority had the power, they do not want the inclination to consign the minority to punishment. I know that claims, self-made, form no small part of the merit to which we have heard undisguised pretenses. But it is the one claim, and it is another thing, very different indeed, to support that claim. The minority, sir, are contending for the rights of mankind. What then are the majority contending for? If the minority are contending for the rights of mankind, the majority must be contending for the doctrines of tyranny and slavery. Is it possible that is the case? Who are the majority in this assembly? Are they not the people? Are they not the representatives of the people as well as the minority? Were they not elected by the people as well as the minority? Were they not elected by the greater part of the people? Have we a single right separate from the rights of the people? Can we forge fetters for others that will not be collapsed round our own limbs? Can we make heavy chains that shall not cramp the growth of our own posterity? On what fancied distinctions shall the minority assume to themselves the merit of contending for the rights of mankind? Now, I definitely don't have enough time to read this next paragraph, but this is a pretty interesting philosophical argument that when we really start looking at it, what ends up happening is the minority basically, you know, pursues supposedly these commonalities. Let's look at the minority of the atheists and the evil people in America that wanted to be able to bring their case to court and be able to pursue justice in our system without acknowledging a greater power or greater being. That in itself created opened the door for duplicity, but I digress. What I'll try to do is I'll try to, you know, cover this in the monologue on this particular paragraph as we lead into the next paragraph. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcasts and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.